Hello, this is the Welcome to Hope podcast brought to you by LifeTree Counseling. I am your host, Rich Killen. What is going on, everybody? I am here with Sam Lample and, of course, our wonderful producer, Whitney. Today, we are going to talk a little bit about, I guess, one of the things that Sam and I align with clinically. Is that a good way of putting it?
That's a good way to put it.
And that is our experience with OCD or obsessive compulsive disorders. Both Sam and I have been trained through the IOCDF website, or not website, trainings, which is the International OCD Foundation. And we both have a lot of experience working with that. Sam, when did you start working with OCD?
Really from the beginning, 2001. There's a significant overlap with OCD and anorexia in particular, but eating disorders in general. And so it's almost impossible to treat eating disorders without treating OCD. And then I got that specialized training you're referring to through the BTTI in 2010, I believe, and really increased the breadth at which I was able to treat it, not just OCD, but all kind of anxiety disorders.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how would you describe OCD to somebody that's not too familiar? I feel like a lot of people aren't quite sure exactly what it is. Mm-hmm. They think it's, you know, they like things neat and tidy, or like things to be a certain way, but that's not exactly what OCD is. So how would you describe that to people?
You hear this term a lot when people who have legitimate OCD, is they get somewhat offended when they hear other people say, oh, I'm so OCD about this or that.
Right.
And that kind of comment's a relatively invalidating comment, because individuals who have real OCD, or, you know, diagnosable clinical OCD, are in torment a lot of times. They don't want the illness. That's right. Why the illness is often described as something we call ego dystonic, in that it is identified as the opposite of the identity that the person wants to have, right? So the illness is an intruder in the person's life. And therefore, someone who has true OCD has real distress on a regular basis. The illness interferes with their lives, with their quality of life, with their ability to live their lives the way they want to. Bring that right into an acceptance and commitment therapy perspective, and you can see where OCD interferes with a person's value-driven behavior.
Right.
And people very much, you know, people who have OCD very much want to be out of it. So, you know, for people who might have a little bit of perfectionism, to say, oh, I'm so OCD about things, a lot of times that can be very discouraging and disheartening, dismissive.
Yeah.
To folks who really have OCD.
Yeah. And I feel like sometimes it's viewed in the general public as this cute little thing, you know, this cute little quirk that somebody might have. But when I talk to people, I like to tell this story. I had a client of mine, when I first started seeing him, he was about 10 years old. With OCD, and he went to go see a psychiatrist to get put on some medication. And this particular psychiatrist is a combat veteran, has been in war, been in battle, seen some pretty crazy things. And this particular psychiatrist had told my 10-year-old client, he said, I would rather go back to war than deal with what you have. And I think that sums it up. I think that is a better picture, I guess, of what OCD really is. It's a war going on in a person's head between being, you know, who they are and what their thoughts are telling them they are. And just real quick, I'm looking at some of the statistics here in case people are wondering. This is straight from the IOCDF website, and about one in 100 adults currently have OCD. So that's approximately 3 million people in the United States, which I think is a lot more than most people would imagine. And about 1 in 200 kids and teens currently have OCD. So it's a lot more prevalent than most people think. Sam, can you give some insight into, I know I get this question a lot, is like, why do I have OCD, or where does it come from? And, you know, what causes it and those kinds of things?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is an interesting topic, right? Because, there, as far as I've been taught by that, you know, the experts in the field going through the IOCDF training, is that if a person's OCD begins prior to age 18, then you can almost be guaranteed up to, I think, 95% certainty that the illness has been genetically predisposed or inherited. And so in other words, most likely at that level, we're going to see either one or both parents who have anxiety issues themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you can see right there, you're talking about not just behavior modeling of what OCD looks like from an adult to a child, but also genetically set up for dealing with the type of brain issues that, you know, the kid with OCD's parents actually have themselves. So it's, I mean, you know, you're not signing up for this stuff.
Right.
Right. You're born this way largely. And unfortunately, in anxious households, the families will go out of their way to try to reassure the child that everything is okay. And that's actually making things far worse than we need it to be.
Mm-hmm.
Reassurance creates a dynamic in which the person who's doing the reassuring is actually the one managing the anxiety for the person who needs the reassurance.
Mm-hmm.
So that person never learns how to deal with their anxiety to begin with.
Right.
You know? And then, but then there's this other kind of dynamic here where there's, I would say that there's some question. I wouldn't necessarily say controversy, but I would say questioning in terms of can a person who has never had OCD have something bad happen to them and develop OCD, almost like a trauma model of OCD.
Right.
And it brings in this bigger question of, does OCD have meaning, or is it just a biological process? Mm-hmm. You know, I would say old school folks very much in the idea that OCD has no meaning. It's simply a brain-based issue. My experience, my eyes, my ears tell me that that's not a complete picture. And the idea that people can develop obsessive compulsive like behaviors, if not full on OCD, as a result of an unexpected trauma in a person's life.
Mm-hmm.
And I have any number of examples of that, mainly from adults that I work with now who have diagnosable OCD, who did not have it at all in childhood, adolescence, or even young adulthood.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until something very, very scary and unexpected happened, and there were some associations made with that event and the things in that event, which prompted these sort of obsessive beliefs about what occurred there. And a lot of what's interesting too, Rich, is that a lot of time that's focused on things like good versus evil.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You'll see a lot of spiritual kind of obsessionality in there. A lot of it focused on devil, Satan, unholy numbers, mm-hmm. things of that nature.
Mm-hmm. Right. The scrupulosity.
Yes. Which is one of our favorites.
Yes.
Yeah. Can you expand on that?
Yeah. So, scrupulosity, is this, I describe it as a intense kind of, moral, oftentimes spiritual beliefs about things. And really just a right or wrong, mindset. Everything has to be right, or just, or something along those lines. And it can look like a lot of different things. And that's, I think, the uniqueness about OCD in general is one person's OCD symptoms is not like the next person's.
Yeah.
So I've seen somebody with this scrupulous form of OCD where they are maybe afraid of demonic possession, or their mind, anytime, let's say they're in church or saying a prayer or even hear a prayer, anytime they hear the word God, their mind automatically turns that to Satan. And so then in their head, they're like, well, now I'm worshiping Satan. And what does that mean? And now I'm going to be damned to hell. And like all of this kind of stuff. And, you know, getting back to what you were talking about earlier, you know, that's the opposite of what they want. These are people that, you know, sincerely believe in and love God and things like that. But, you know, that's just the brain, the way that their brain is working in that given moment. You know, and then I've also seen people that maybe aren't so religious, but they have a kind of a strict sort of moral code on how things should work and operate. Mm-hmm. And if things don't work in that way, then that just throws them out of whack.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that ties a little bit into kind of another segment of this, which is the OCPD, the obsessive compulsive personality disorder.
Yeah. Can I chime in on scrupulosity we make that transition? Because that is a great transition. And we want to get to OCPD as quickly as possible because it's so interesting. Scrupulosity, as you know, Rich, you were really nailing this. So that the word scruple is a French word and it refers to like this sharp pebble in your shoe that you can't quite get rid of. So every step you take, there's a reminder of how a little thing in life can cause a tremendous amount of pain.
Interesting.
And so the beginning of scrupulosity had nothing to do with religion, which is primarily what it has to do with now.
Yeah.
It was more so morality. It was the right versus the wrong. It was living an upright lifestyle, a pious lifestyle. And, you know, not offending others, focus on justice versus injustice. And then over time, it's sort of morphed into, oh, well, scrupulosity is about religion. And it is to an extent. Mm-hmm. But we also have to consider, as you were describing, the moral aspect of it. It may have nothing to do with religion at all.
Right.
But I love the concept, again, of like, of just words. And that sense of having a pebble in our shoe. I mean, you think about it. You walk around, you have a pebble in your shoe. What's the first thing you want to do? You want to get rid of that thing. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing with OCD. It's an irritant.
Right.
You know, you get tired of having almost a second voice in your head just constantly chattering and telling you what you should or shouldn't do and how you should or shouldn't do it and when it has to be done and the manner in which it has to be done. But you're not able to shut it off.
Right.
Where individuals who don't have OCD are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there's the torment in a sense. And a lot of people don't know this, but really high levels of obsessionality are right on the verge of a psychotic process. Mm-hmm. Like the most extreme forms of OCD would often be misdiagnosed as psychosis.
Mm-hmm.
Because that obsessionality is so high, a person who's not trained in a diagnosis of OCD would miss the obsessionality for a person being disconnected from reality.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And I remember, you know, just running into that from time to time of having people transferred to us and, you know, and the referring professional is like, I don't know what's going on here. You know, I think this person needs to be in a facility.
Yeah.
And maybe they do, right? But the reality is, you know, you spend about 5 or 10 minutes with them, you understand, okay, what is the nature of this quote-unquote psychotic thought, relatively easy to identify. Oh, no, that's just really strong OCD.
Yeah. Okay. So what about the OCPD then?
Yeah, OCPD, obsessive-compulsive personality disorder. One of my faves, actually. I'd say less common. My assumption is statistically it's less common than OCD. I'm not sure if you have a number on that or not.
No.
And I don't expect you to have it because it would be really be putting you on a spot for that one. But yeah, OCPD falls under the categories of, you know, what we used to call characterological disorders or personality disorders in the DSM. And it's interesting because it's in a sense, OCPD looks very much like OCD, except for it's not driven by the genetic predisposition. It comes more from temperament and, as I mentioned before, personality. So the person with OCPD actually loves being or having OCPD because their belief system is they know better than anybody else. And if people would simply just follow their rules about living, life would be fine. You know, you have, and there's some really interesting sort of things about how, you know, if you look at the diagnostic criteria, there's a quote unquote miserly attitude towards money. There's a significant focus on controlling type behavior.
Right.
And oftentimes there's a collection of things that we sort of similar to hoarding, but not quite. But all in all, like the idea lives by this individual with OCPD lives by a certain set of rules that they've created for themselves that they believe are 100% the right way to do it. So chances of you creating a whole lot of change with this type of individual is not great. And therefore, you're not going to see them very much because they don't think they have a problem.
Right. They like it.
Yeah. 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 It's just how you live life. Matter of fact, in my experience, the only time a person with OCPD actually shows up in an office, it's because a family member has kind of had enough.
Right.
And said, you're going to talk to someone about this, or I'm leaving.
Right.
But still, that doesn't create a significant amount of change.
Yeah. Yeah. So I want to talk a little bit about kind of the different themes. I've heard some people talk about the different flavors of OCD. Yeah. You know, when I went to my BTTI training, they said that there's really three different types of themes, three themes for OCD. There's your what they call the specific phobias. So afraid of needles or bridges or heights or those types of things. Then there's this just right, where things have to be done a particular way, but you can't really quantify what that looks like. So, for example, I had somebody where they had to their car door had to be shut a certain way, and if it wasn't shut a certain way, then they didn't feel like it was shut.
Yeah.
But there's no way to demonstrate or describe what that would look like. It was just more of a feeling.
Yes.
And then the third form is more of a kind of a almost like a magical thinking kind of aspect, where it you know, maybe the scrupulosity stuff could come into play, or it's a, if I don't do this a certain way, then something bad might happen.
Yeah.
Those types of things. Does that pretty much cover it from your perspective?
I mean, I think that's a broad stroke.
Right. Yeah.
You know, but if that's what the experts say, you know, we should probably pay attention to them a little bit. Maybe we bring in some of our own perspective as yeah. well. You know, like the just right OCD stuff, I think is fascinating because you described it perfectly. It has nothing to do with set numbers or amounts or volume or anything like that. It's simply, or whatever the behavior is, it's repeated until the person feels okay about it or feels right at that point. Sometimes it happens relatively quickly, but I've had a person, similar car situation, except for this person wouldn't allow themselves to exit the car until they felt just right about leaving the car. Mm-hmm. So here in the Phoenix area, they might spend 6 to 8 hours in the car in the middle of the summer, till the gas runs out, till the air condition no longer functions,
right?
And maybe they don't have power to get the windows down, but they don't allow themselves to exit the car until something clicks,
right?
You know, and if you ask them to describe it, it's not going to happen usually. Mm-hmm. There's just a sense of knowing, like, I'll know it when I feel it.
Right.
And then I can get out of the car. Just the, you know, sad stuff, amazing mm-hmm. stuff. Mm-hmm. This really like flavor I like this of OCD that I really like working with. I was taught that this is called OCD of essence.
Okay.
Or maybe OCD of identity. And it happens, this particular presentation of OCD happens more with adolescents or children, primarily adolescents. It has a lot to do with a person wanting to keep the best aspects of themselves while making sure that they keep away the worst aspects of someone else.
Interesting.
Yes. Oh, it's amazing.
Interesting.
And when we take it one step further, the compulsions associated with OCD of essence oftentimes occur in physical places of transition in a person's life, aka doorways, thresholds to different rooms, mm-hmm. and any kind of delineation from one space to another. Mm-hmm. You'll see a lot of tapping, a lot of checking of doorknobs, a lot of opening and closing doors, a lot of hesitation to step from one room into the other room, mm-hmm. because the thought process is, whatever good aspect of me exists in this space might not transition with me into that space, right? Or I know there's someone in that other space that I don't want to be like.
Right.
So I'm not going to step into that room. That's so-and-so's room. So-and-so's bad for me. Mm-hmm. So-and-so's not an upright person. They're not mm-hmm. an honest person. And I remember, like, I had seen this in some people with eating disorders before, but never knew that it was called something until I had my training. Hmm. And then realized, oh, so this is an actual thing.
Yeah.
And then once you know something's a thing, then you're able to actually look for it now.
Right.
And then after that, I was able to probably work with two or three adolescents. This is not super common. Hmm. But once you recognize it, like, you can see this is actually happening. So one of the more difficult cases I've ever worked with was a person who had a combination of just right OCD, OCD of essence, an eating disorder, and magical thinking. It was like treating four different illnesses at the same time.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, in that just right OCD, you can put kind of perfectionism in there. You know, and so these are those people that, you know, if you're working on a project at school, you just can't move forward until it looks perfect, perfect to them, not necessarily perfect to the teacher or perfect to somebody else. That could be their handwriting, that could be the wording, you know, but as you can imagine, this will take hours longer than it probably should. You know, so yeah, the just right OCD is pretty fascinating to me. I mean, it's all fascinating, but, you know, and then you've got the more magical thinking kinds of things. I'm trying to think of some of the more common cases that I've had. You know, I've had somebody I worked with who was afraid of a particular color. Mm. But the reason they were afraid of that color is because a authority figure in their life that was their favorite color, and that person was not a good person to them. Mm. So kind of along what you were talking about. Mm-hmm. And so they were afraid that if I then touch or drink or have any sort of association with this color, then I will then become like this person. Mm. You know, I've got other people that you know, again, with the colors where maybe something bad happened while wearing that color. And so now that color is kind of contaminated, and wearing that color or anything to do with that color will then result in something else bad happening.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And then of course you've got your, what I call more of the stereotype is your hand washing, the germ contamination. Mm-hmm. But even that can go in so many different directions because it's not always just about an illness or getting sick.
Right.
It can be, I've had people worried about getting sick to the point that either they lose like functioning or they are somehow not in reality. Mm-hmm. They could care less about getting sick or even getting so sick that they end up dying. It's, they don't want to be removed from reality because of some sort of illness or being drugged or something along those lines. Mm-hmm. So it's just these many nuances, where it can look like a contamination OCD, but it's so very different from one person to the next.
Yeah. Yeah. You've done a phenomenal job describing it's presenting the idea that OCD doesn't look specific to a large number of people, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's specific to a person.
Right.
And then you're describing a little bit this concept of OCD float. And what that means basically is that the obsessions and compulsions that a person might have at month one may be very different by the time you get to month mm-hmm. six.
Right.
And so we say, well, what happened there? Right. Well, it's the person lives out their lives individually. So any number of dynamics affect the OCD. Mm-hmm. But really what's happening is that, you know, fear-based learning happens quickly and it's highly generalizable. So if I have a fear-based learning style about issue A, then that caused my obsession to begin with. And eventually I'm going to start having some fear-based learning around issue B and C and D and E. And now I have this whole other line of obsessions and compulsions that I'm having to work into my OCD picture.
Right.
And, you know, I think a lot of times people might say, well, you know, they might look at that and say, well, if your symptoms were here and now they're here, that's a sign of you not having a real issue. And I would say that that's a terrible mistake, mm-hmm. right? OCD is not going to look the same all the time. And it might start at A and it might go to B and it might come back to A in a matter of months. That doesn't mean it's any less potent than,
right.
you know, a more stable picture of OCD. But as I was listening to you, I was thinking, you know, you brought back to me the idea of, does it always have to be a brain-based, primarily a brain-based issue that's genetically predisposed? Mm-hmm. Because for me, the answer is like, no, it can't be, because there's too many issues where people have trauma-like situations that create trauma-like behaviors that look like compulsions that are really just designed to keep a person safe.
Right.
They aren't so much about avoiding a magically identified feared outcome, you know, I'd be really curious, like if we were doing a call-in show, I wonder what people would call in and say about that.
Yeah.
Especially individuals who have those trauma type OCD presentations versus individuals who have more of the, the typical, you know, 100% brain-based issue, you know, because there's so many parts of the brain that are alive and well in OCD. They just don't function in harmony with each other like they're supposed to.
Right.
Right. And so, and you mentioned this before too. I mean, OCD is very much like a person living with their brain working against them at yeah. all times.
Yeah.
Now, if you can imagine trying to drive a car, except for that car has a mind of its own, mm-hmm. you know, at any point in time, that car is going to turn up whichever way it wants to turn.
Yeah.
And you have a choice.
Yeah.
You know, you can resist it or have your hands broken in half because the car is going this direction, or you can lean into it because you don't have any other choice.
Yeah.
You know, it really is torment, I think, is the word that I would use, because it's a word that I hear the most from individuals with severe OCD. Being in their heads is like being tormented.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think some of the I don't want to say worst, because that's probably not the right way to put it, but some of the hardest ones to kind of work with would be the, you know, these people with harm OCD, where they are terrified that they will either hurt themselves or hurt somebody else. Mm-hmm. Or like a pedophile OCD kind of a thing, where you're afraid that you will, you know, harm a child.
Yeah.
Because this really gets into, you know, it really ties into like their identity as a person, and they feel like they are the worst of the worst because they are having these thoughts. Even though they've never acted on them.
Right.
But just the idea of having these thoughts is so scary. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of times that brings on, you know, depression and, you know, their own suicidal ideation and things of that nature. And that complicates things a lot.
Yeah.
So part of the reason I wanted to bring that up is just, you know, in case somebody out there is listening to this and is struggling with any of these things, that there is help and there is, you know, people who understand this. Because what I found in treating people with especially that kind of form of OCD is that they're afraid to talk about it because, you know, they're going to get locked up in jail or something of that nature.
Yeah.
And so I want to make sure that people understand that you know, there is a treatment for that. There is hope. There's people that understand it and aren't just ready to, you know, call the cops. And I had one client ask me if I had a button under my desk that would alert the authorities if they mentioned something like that to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think, you know, maybe that sounds a little silly and maybe it doesn't, but I think that's kind of the reality of how some of these people think.
They absolutely think that way. I think there's a dynamic with folks with OCD in which they don't want to say certain of their obsessions or certain of their compulsions out loud, because once they do, it's going to sound more true. And that as long as it's internalized and kept to themselves, right? Like nobody has to be exposed to how quote unquote crazy they are.
Hmm.
And, you know, I like the fact that you've identified that there's treatment and hope, you know, because one of the things that has been a pet peeve of mine about the entire mental health world is that we're oftentimes really good at identifying the problem, yeah, but not so good at actually doing anything about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like we can talk about it.
Right.
Right. Like we're doing right now. We have a podcast about the problem of OCD, but the good news is we're also going to bring in the hope aspect of it.
Yeah.
And the fact that there is treatment, exposure with response prevention therapy, there's medication that's effective, and all kinds of techniques associated with treatment of OCD that have been around for hundreds of years that are tried and true.
Yeah.
And that people do, it's not so much you find recovery from obsessive compulsive disorder, because the brain, the way the brain functions is not something that can be completely restored per se. But you, through these techniques, you can learn a significant mastery in life again and have a really strong decrease in symptomology that causes a person distress. You know, we at LifeTree have an intensive outpatient program and designed to help individuals who are stuck in the throes of OCD.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we're not the only people that do, right? So make this very clear. We want you to know about our program, because if you need help and you live near us, we want you to come find us. But if you don't live anywhere near us and you need help, we want to encourage you that you can find help, because there's a lot of qualified professionals across the country who have the same training that we have, offer similar programs that we do, that are ready to meet you where you're at and help you find some freedom.
Yeah.
You know, that's the goal.
Yeah.
You don't have to live in that sort of isolated jail anymore. Is it hard to get out of it? Yes, absolutely it is. And possible to get out of it.
Right.
That's the key, right? So we have more than enough experience with individuals who would have said, there's no hope for me. There's no way I can get past any of this, who are living lives today that they would have believed to be unimaginable just 3 to 6 months ago. Mm-hmm. So that's our encouragement.
Yeah.
You know, is that this works. Treatment works. Intensive outpatient therapy works. It's roughly 9 hours a week of therapy, preferably for 3 months. And, man, we'd love the opportunity to help you.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And I'll throw this out there just so I don't forget to do it later. But if you live near us here in Arizona, again, you can feel free to reach out to us, and whether it's with us or with somebody else, we can, help you out if you're struggling with OCD. But if you are outside of Arizona, you can always go to the iocdf.org website. That's the International OCD Foundation. And they have a button there that you can just search for people and programs across the world, really. But you mentioned exposure therapy, exposure and response prevention. How do you describe that to people?
So exposure with response prevention, or ERP, is the Rolls Royce of OCD treatment, and really needs to be a part of just about every form of not just OCD treatment, but any anxiety-based issue, in my opinion. Because it's the only thing that gives the brain learning opportunities to develop a new relationship with anxiety.
Right.
And until we do that, you know, until the brain has multiple learning opportunities, nothing is really going to change. So with exposure, we are creating what's called a fear hierarchy, which we identify low-level fears up to the highest-level fears, and we slowly start to introduce a person to those lower-level of fears until they develop a sense of mastery in terms of their ability to sit with their fear without their anxiety running rampant in their lives.
Right.
Once they realize they can do that at lower levels, then we increase them, you know, systematically one level at a time. And by the time the individuals get through their fear hierarchy, they're often... they've often experienced a significant amount of relief and decrease in symptomology.
Right.
So the goal is we put the person in the presence of their fear without having them do the same things that they would normally do to make their fear go away, which we call compulsions.
Right.
Right. So, and of course, a person has to agree to this too. You can't force a person into doing exposure with response prevention. You'll get absolutely nothing out of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know? You can override a person's will, but that's not the same thing as actually doing therapy or having that person engaged in a learning experience.
Right.
And notice I keep saying learning experience, because that's really the best way to look at all of this these days. It's how many times can the brain be introduced into a situation to relearn a safety-based learning approach to override the fear-based learning that has occurred within the OCD.
Yeah.
Repetitions is what we need.
Right.
Over and over. They're not so much the prolonged habituation cycles that we used to have, like 90 minutes to 2 hours per se.
Mm-hmm.
It's now more about how many episodes can we introduce into a person's life to have that brain have a chance to do what? Learn. So where does intensive outpatient therapy come into this? Well, it's just a math issue. You know, if you're doing 1 hour of therapy per week, you have 1 hour worth of learning opportunities. If you're doing 9 hours of therapy per week, you have 9 hours of learning opportunities. And if we just do the math, 1 hour a week times 4 weeks in a month, that's 4 hours. 9 hours a week times 4 weeks in a month is 36 hours. And the question is, for you as an individual, if you're thinking about increased treatment, it's how quickly do you want to feel better?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's really what it boils down to. Is it scary? Of course it's scary to face someone's fears. Anyone would say that whether we have OCD or not.
Yeah.
This is more of an issue, if we bring it back to acceptance and commitment therapy, it's more of an issue of, are you living a life of value when you're trapped in obsessive compulsive disorder? Chances are no.
Right. Yeah.
You know? So Rich, if somebody wanted to connect with us and get in our fantastic LifeTree IOP program, what would they do?
Yeah. So two ways to do it. One, you can give us a call at 602-488-6104. Or you can just shoot us an email at info@lifetreecounselingaz.com. Those are probably the two best ways to do it. You could also go through our website, which is lifetreecounselingaz.com. And there is a contact tab there, and you can put in your information, and our wonderful admin will be in touch with you really quick. So, yeah. So we just wanted to make sure that we covered this topic because it is a very misunderstood topic, as we touched on. And it's also something that both Sam and I are passionate about in our treatment. And so going forward with our future podcasts, we want to be able to provide more content like this for you guys, not only with just Sam and I, but even with our other therapists who have other amazing specialties that, that they are very knowledgeable about. And so we will continue to be providing more content like this. So stay tuned.
All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you next episode.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. Follow us on social media to get more information about next week's episode. The content in this program is not intended to be a substitute for professional counseling, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your mental health professional or other qualified health provider with any questions you may have. Never disregard professional advice or delay in seeking counseling because of something you have heard on this podcast. If you are in crisis or think you may have an emergency, call 911 immediately. If you are in Maricopa County, Arizona, and are in a behavioral health crisis, call 1-800-631-1314. If you are outside of Maricopa County, please call your local crisis hotline or call 1-800-273-8255 to talk to a skilled, trained counselor at a crisis center in your area at any time. If you are located outside of the United States, call your local emergency line immediately. The content in this program is not intended to be a substitute for professional counseling, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your mental health professional or other qualified health provider with any questions you may have. Never disregard professional advice or delay in seeking counseling because of something you have heard on this podcast. If you or someone you know is in need of counseling in the state of Arizona, feel free to call us at 602-488-6104. If you are in crisis or think you may have an emergency, call 911 immediately. If you are in Maricopa County, Arizona, and are in a behavioral health crisis, you can call the crisis hotline at 1-800-631-1314. If you are outside of Maricopa County, please call your local crisis hotline or call 1-800-273-8255. If you are located outside the United States, call your local emergency line immediately.